You're listening to a punk movie review right here on the Prairie Punk Press Network.
You gonna get a burn?
Guess so.
I never thought twice about getting mine.
Is that right? Why not?
Because I have so many scars already.
What kind of scars?
These kind.
Jesus, what's that from?
I'll tell you about it someday if I ever get to know you better.
Hi everyone, you're listening to Punk Movie Review. We are on episode 3 of Punk Movie Review. This time we're going to be doing The Other Suburbia, the 1983 Penelope Spheeris film. The synopsis is, when household tensions and a sense of worthlessness overcome Evan, he finds escape when he clings with the orphans of a throwaway society. The runaways hold on to each other like a family until a tragedy tears them apart.
Would
you say tragedy? That's a pretty accurate synopsis? What's that?
Which tragedy?
There's a lot peppered in there.
Yeah,
there's quite a few. Mm-hmm. So we're doing the 1983 Suburbia. I'm Neckbone.
Hi, I'm Jerbear. Spoiler alert for a 41-year-old movie about some punk rock kids in L.A. Yeah. If you haven't seen it, go watch it before you listen to this podcast, because we're going to spoil all of it.
Absolutely. We will give away the twist ending. It's not really much of a twist.
And don't accidentally watch the 1996 Richard Linklater Suburbia.
What happened to both of us. back in like 2002 or whenever it was that I worked at a video store.
Oh, for you, yeah. I think it was 2000 or 2001 for me.
Oh, really?
Yeah, my girlfriend at the time and myself. I was like, ooh, Suburbia. I'm supposed to watch this.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, did I watch it. 3 times in my life.
I am so sorry. I will say this Suburbia, what I will from now on call the real Suburbia. Mm-hmm. So whenever you hear me say the real Suburbia, I'm talking about the 1983 Suburbia.
Yeah.
I definitely would say that this Suburbia is better than the other one.
Yeah. How long has it been? When's the last time you saw this, the real Suburbia?
Last week now.
Well, before that.
Oh, like 2003 or something like that?
Yeah, probably 2001 or 2 for me. It's been a good while. I forgot about some of it, so.
Yeah. I forgot about a lot of it. So Penelope Spheeris directed this. She also wrote it. She also, I think, edited it too. And it's produced by Roger Corman.
Yeah, I saw that. That was surprised by that. And she wrote this after Decline of Western Civilization 1, right? After hanging out with all the punks in L.A. She did that documentary and then decided to make a narrative film about LA punks.
All of the cast are all punk rockers that she just found around LA.
Yeah, there's only,
including Flea.
Yeah, right. Credited as Mike B. the Flea.
Right. And for anyone who doesn't know, because I realize that maybe younger listeners may be lucky enough to not know that much about Red Hot Chili Peppers. But Flea is the bassist for the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Did you know he also played bass in the Circle Jerks for a while?
I did not know that.
He sure did. Probably around the time they made this movie.
Did you know that he is also Australian?
Yeah. Well, I know that he's like a military brat and born down there. Or
well,
something.
His dad's Australian.
Oh, okay.
Or his mom. One of his parents is Australian.
But he traveled around a lot. Because I was when I was watching this, I was doing some research about it, and I was like, I need to know more about this Flea character. And yeah, Australia, and then like New Jersey or some shit.
Upstate Utah, New York. Yeah.
All sorts of shit. Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was in the Circle Jerks for a little while.
That's interesting. I actually did not know that. I'll give my one piece of movie Flea trivia while we're still on the subject, so we don't have to come back to it again. So in the movie Suburbia, there is one of the goofs. For anyone who decided to go ahead and watch this or has just seen enough to be familiar with it, there's a scene in Jack's car where Jack calls Flea, whose character name is Razzle, mm-hmm. accidentally calls him Flea.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, where's the house, Flea?
I think the lead singers are
where's
really
the house, Flea?
Hold on, it's coming. It's coming.
Come on. Yeah. I've been driving around for hours.
No, you cut it on for like
days,
hours.
Please.
And my name is Rabbit.
Come on, out of here. Here's the corner.
Where are we going?
Hold on.
And Flea, as Razzle, says, over there. Hey, my name's Razzle, man. So,
yeah.
they got his character name wrong. Because I noticed that he called him Flea in the car. And it's like, oh, is that his fucking character's name too? No, it was not. No, and they left it in. I love that. Yeah. That's great.
Good job. I'll be serious.
that is, I find something like that, I actually find endearing.
Oh, yeah.
What I didn't find endearing about the movie was the sexual assault, racism, and homophobia that was kind of just peppered around kind of all throughout and was not played off as like, these people are wrong for thinking this way and now they're going to learn a lesson. It was just in there, didn't really have anything to do with the story.
Yeah. So I had lunch with our friend Alex last week and told him we were going to, you know, review the real Suburbia. And he brought some of that up and had some good points that he brought up that I would like to share with everyone. That it's actually like a pretty good mirror for punks of our generation to look back at that scene in the 80s, which really wasn't as inclusive and welcoming of everyone. And like our view of what punk rock was in the 90s isn't what the hardcore scene was in LA back then, because it was very machismo, and you know, it was the 80s, so homophobia was much more rampant and racism out there, you know, was much more prevalent. It's not to say that black people were a part of the punk community, obviously, you know, Polystyrene, Bad Brains, mm-hmm. Pure Hell, you know, there was clearly a connection there. And, you know, even, you know, on the East Coast, certainly hip hop and punk rock were pretty close.
But yeah, I think one of the things that a lot of people forget about California, and in particular Southern California, is, you know, it's, you know, people have this idea of who lives in California, but you've got places like Orange County, especially Orange County back then, which was kind of being built. I mean, there's a lot of conservative mentality out there. You saw that from the townspeople.
Yeah.
I mean, these are the same people who would chase us around Kansas.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, my God, they named their airport after John Wayne.
Right.
I mean, that's not something that the left would do.
Right.
I mean, there was a lot of crossover between like the punk and hip hop scene.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it wasn't weird to see a punk rocker at a hip hop show. It wasn't weird to see people who are into the hip hop scene at a punk rock show.
Right. That scene, I mean, I've heard stories of it being pretty bad, really macho and kind of gross. Mm-hmm. And this movie kind of, you know, shines a light on some of that. Punk scene from back then. So it is interesting to see how punk rock changed and what it has evolved into. But one thing that is consistent is the strong sense of community, because it's a very big part of movie and, mm-hmm. you know, sticking together and helping one another out and, you know, doing what you think is right in regards to how broken society is and not wanting to be a part of that. And, yeah. and I think that's like one of the core tenets of the punk ethos, not just punk rock music, but the punk ethos is that, you know, society is broken and I don't want to be a part of it because it is so yeah. broken, you know, and that, right. and that definitely shows up there. I mean, they live in a squat, you know what I mean? And mm-hmm. it was interesting to me how the antagonists in the movie were suburban rednecks.
Right.
I didn't remember it being like that. I thought it was yuppies for some reason. And, you know, went back and watched it and they're like suburban rednecks. It was very weird.
It's interesting because it does. And, you know, I'm guessing that, I mean, it must have been somewhat intentional, but I mean, it's a pretty anti-capitalist movie.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, the whole decaying suburbs, the urban sprawl mm-hmm. or suburban sprawl, you know, and, you know, the townspeople who were, you know, angry rednecks, sure, but the reason they were angry is a lot of them were getting laid off from their factory jobs.
Mm-hmm. It's a nice camper, but if you're so in love with it, why are you selling it?
Oh, we don't want to. Got a lot of money tied up in this.
Yeah, you know, we've used it just about every weekend for the last 3 years, but since the layoff, we've had to cut back a little on recreation.
Oh, you were with GM?
12 long years.
14 for me. It's a hell of a note. Makes it tough to get out and have a good time when you can't afford the gas.
Tell you what, let me think about it. Maybe I'll give you a call. Have a nice day.
You know, they were losing the American dream was slipping away,
right?
And they needed somebody to blame. Yeah. And, you know, those kids presented a good scapegoat. Well, right. They're the reason why, when no, they're just living in an abandoned house.
Right. Well, and I think
that was abandoned because of capitalism.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, Penelope Spheres did a good job of showing what kind of kids got into punk, you know, by mm-hmm. and large, you know, people that are left behind, people that are abused, and people that are just disillusioned by the fucking world, you know? And, you know, most of our friends were
searching for community.
Yeah. Felt like they didn't belong anywhere until we found punk, and then it was like, oh, this makes sense to me, and these people
right
make sense to me, and so you form a community and a family, and they were, you know, these kids were a family and they took care of one another as well as they could mm-hmm. you know, and that's, you know, that's kind of what we did too. We took care right. of each other as best we could.
We talked about that in one of the first couple episodes of A Prairie Punk House Companion, where we talked about, you know, we didn't fit in anywhere else. Mm-hmm. So where else were we going to go? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of icing on the cake that the music was good too.
Yeah.
Like, but that's initially not what I was looking for. It was just, you know, it just happened that I also liked the music mm-hmm. and liked the aesthetic of it as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I was looking for somewhere where I could, you know, just be myself
yeah.
and not have to sit there and constantly code switch. I could just kind of be me
yeah.
and people would accept that. And I think we found that, and it looked like, you know, in this movie, that's what those kids were looking for too.
Yeah. The opening scene is something people talk about a lot. And I, you know, I was, at, you know, now that I'm a dad, I have a hard time with violence towards children. So I wasn't looking forward to the opening scene at all.
I was dreading
so,
it. In fact, I put off watching this movie mm-hmm. for like an extra week because I didn't know if I could handle mm-hmm. that opening scene.
So the opening scene, Sheila is running away from home, and she hitchhikes and gets picked up by this mother and her toddler. There's like maybe 18 months, 2 years old, something like that.
Right. Who's sitting in the front seat with no car seat.
Right. It was the 80s.
That's beside the point.
and then the mom stops to make a phone call at a phone booth from a payphone, which no longer
in the middle
exists.
Of nowhere. A payphone that is just in a field.
Yeah, basically.
Which I grew up in the payphone era.
Yeah.
You know, we're children of the, you know, babies of the 70s. Mm-hmm. So we grew up in the payphone era. I have literally never seen a payphone in the middle of a field before, but I don't know.
Yeah, we didn't live in California. Maybe that's a California thing.
That's how they roll out there.
So the mom is on the phone, and this strange girl that this mother doesn't know is like, here, watch my kid while I'm on the phone. And they're just standing outside of the phone booth instead of waiting in the car, which would maybe be safer, better idea.
Right.
But now they're just standing there in a place that's known for wild dog attacks, like roaming packs of wild dogs. So anyway, like the dogs kill the toddler. It doesn't look real. It looks like they're playing with the doll. So like there was the shock of it from what I remember is not nearly as bad as what I saw when rewatched it.
It's such a unshocking scene that I couldn't believe that I was scared to watch it. I laughed out loud when I actually saw it because it is so obvious that it's just a doll.
Yeah.
And like the dog looks like it's playing the same way that my dog plays with toys. I give it like when I'm like playing with him.
Yeah.
He's like, just like playing with this thing. And I'm like, oh,
those dogs don't look vicious at all. They don't look vicious like cute little puppies.
At all. Right. Like, and in fact, I would guess that the growling was just 80 yard in.
Oh yeah.
Most of the time.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Like
those dogs are smiling.
Like
they're just having
some of those dogs were making like the same, like showing their teeth that like the same way my dog does when I've got a treat ready for him.
Yeah.
Like he's like getting ready to eat the treat.
Uh-huh. And maybe, like you know, maybe it's different now that we have, you know, 480p or whatever, 4K TVs, and we can see more of that. But, you know, instead of like grainy film, it may have looked more shocking and less dull.
Also, the dog, when the dog approaches them, what's the girl's name?
Sheila.
Yeah. When the dog approaches them, Sheila is standing next to the toddler and she just stands there. She doesn't try to block the toddler or like be like, go away, dog. She stands there and just kind of is just like awkwardly stands there. And just like, okay, well, here's this toddler for you. It doesn't make any sense. It is not how normal people behave. Right. Even people who are traumatized would more than likely at least be like, there's this dog growling at your kid. Can your kid just go into the phone booth with you right now?
So what's the point of that scene?
Is to it just show to set up how vicious Southern California right there is.
Well,
near John Wayne Airport.
I mean, they bring up later that there are these roving packs of wild dogs and Razzle is trying to tame them. And that's really
he's got a couple of them.
The dogs come back throughout the movie, but I mean, you could set that up without killing a baby.
you know?
I mean, it's probably for shock value. You
know? It is.
Like, here's this movie is going to be edgy. Check it out. We killed a baby.
Right. That's so you know in the first 5 seconds, this movie's not fucking around. this movie's going to blow your fucking mind. Yeah, it is a hilariously shot scene. The dog does not really look vicious. And you can tell it's a doll. It doesn't make sense the way that people are, like, moving and behaving.
Yeah.
And I realized that, you know, the director didn't use any, I don't think she used any real actors.
I think there's two professional actors. Chris Peterson, I don't know if he was before, but he went on to be in Point Break and some other stuff. And,
nice.
I don't remember who else. I think Bill Coyne went on to be in some other stuff too, and then retired from acting. And he played Evan.
Okay.
Chris Peterson was Jack Diddley.
Mm-hmm.
His dad was the cop, which is a bummer. Or his stepdad is a cop, which is a bummer. He's also black. Oh man!
Right, that line, I did not remember that line. So if I remember right, the line is, my stepdad's a cop. And then the other guy goes, oh, that sucks. And he goes, but what's worse is he's black. And I'm like, wait, that's worse?
Keep going, fuckers. My old man's a cop. Well, my stepdad, my real father ate in Vietnam. My mom got married again.
God, your stepdad's a cop.
Yeah, that's not the worst of it, though. It's black.
Black cop. What a drag.
It's terrible. It's fucking terrible.
A cop? Like, I feel like him being a cop is one of the worst things.
Yeah.
Like, the only way you could get worse than that is if you're like, my dad's a Nazi.
Right.
I don't think it gets
much
worse.
And he's black.
I know. I'm just like, wait, what's bad about that exactly?
Right. Yeah, it's just, it's,
and
that's really,
and then when
gross.
They go pick up the other friend and they're like, you know, they say his dad's F slur for a gay man.
Mm-hmm.
So he can't stand it there anymore.
Right.
And his dad actually, in the few scenes he was in, his
seemed
dad seems pretty friendly and laid back.
Both of them seem
like he's just like, oh, you're here looking for my kid? He's in his room. Go see if you can cheer him up.
Yeah.
And you're like, why is it difficult to live with this guy? He seems like a joy.
Yeah. And I think that guy is the bass player for U.S. Bombs with Dwayne Peters, who is a huge fucking shitbag now. Maybe because of all the traumatic brain injuries that he's had, but he's like a huge Trump supporter. And
to support somebody like Donald Trump or the Republican Party in 2024 is the most unpunk thing that you can probably do.
Yeah.
Besides wearing swastika armbands, I'm looking at you, Sex Pistols.
I mean, I even question like punks that proudly support Democrats. So after they kill the baby, it cuts, you know, there's the opening scene or whatever, and then they're at a show. Who's the band playing that first show?
D.I. is the first band that plays.
Mm-hmm. And that's where the first sexual assault happens. And one of the punk rockers hits on what I guess is like a poser, maybe? Or
I mean, I feel like she's just like a preppy who just went to a show because she just wanted to go watch some music. Or, you know, maybe she is even like, I mean, she's obviously young. She probably, I mean, we had a lot of like preppies who'd show up to our shows who are just like, I just like this music, but my parents make me wear this. Uh-huh. You know, shit like that happened all the time in the scene. You know, baby punks, maybe like they're maybe thinking about
just dipping their
Dipping their toe and getting involved in the scene, but it probably doesn't help if you sexually assault them at their first show.
So the one guy, is he one of the main characters?
No, he was just some random guy.
He hits on her and she rejects him. And so he insults her and then rips her clothes off. And then there's a pit around her and all of the punks that are, not all the punks there, but, you know, a good number of the punks there, like, toss her around and continue taking off her clothes. And it's really gross. And it serves a purpose later in the movie, but it's really stupid. And it's a bit shocking coming from a female filmmaker.
I don't find that scene to be necessary.
No.
At all.
I think I'd like to fuck your brains out.
What?
I said, I think I'd like to fuck your brains out.
Oh, you would, huh?
Yeah, but it doesn't look like you have any.
Yeah.
they could have without the sexual assault, they could have just had some guy come up and be a creep to her,
right.
Which, you know, is pretty common.
Right. Or insult her or call her a poser.
Creep her out, mm-hmm. Make her feel unsafe, you know, and like they could have established, you know, kind of, you know, trauma mm-hmm. based on like some guy who just won't leave her alone. They didn't need to actually sexually assault her. And that part of the trailer, because I asked my wife if she wanted to watch this one with me, mm-hmm. and she watched the trailer, and that part of the trailer, she was like, nope, I'm out.
I didn't know. I didn't realize that was in the trailer. That's a bold move. That was a bold move to put that in the trailer. Yeah, it's
and
really
I was like, I don't even remember that scene. And then there's a lot of other shit in there too. But yeah, and then I told her, I said, yeah, this is the suburbia that's directed and written by a woman uh-huh. too.
Yeah, it's really unnecessary. It doesn't move the plot forward at all. They use it as a plot device later in the movie. It's completely unnecessary. You could do the same thing without having a violent sexual assault in your film. It's just gross.
I think the 80s, early 80s LA punk rock scene, I think it just is unfamiliar to us because mm-hmm. it's, you know, and we've both, you know, listened to and read interviews and read biographies and autobiographies, you know, and stuff from punks who were part of that scene. And it's like, that just seems to be par for the course,
right?
Of that whole Southern California, you know, and I know, one of the guys from a JFA, and like, yeah, he was like, the LA scene was pretty rough.
Yeah.
So it is an accurate depiction.
I'm sure it is. It's gross.
I don't think it needed to be in the movie. I think you could still have the movie be pretty gritty and dark without, you know, start. And that's pretty early in the film. That's in the first like 15 minutes, I want to say.
It's right after there's the opening scene with the baby mm-hmm. that dies. There's the credits where they're walking down the street, and then it immediately mm-hmm. goes to that show and that happens. It's like 5 minutes, 10 minutes in the movie tops. It's like right at the beginning. You know, and then after that is when we meet the cast of characters. Aside from Sheila, we met her obviously hitchhiking.
The first character we meet from our main group, Evan. So yeah, Evan is the first one we meet. He's got kind of a rough home. He has a little brother, and his mom comes in, takes the bottle of vodka out of the oven, which I guess is a thing that they do keep the vodka in the oven, and she, you know, says, hey, I marked it, I know you've been drinking it, and basically just verbally abuses him, and he decides to leave. And then it goes into the scene of him just walking down the streets of LA mm-hmm. Looking for a place to go, and he wanders into the punk show, the DI show, mm-hmm. where the sexual assault happens. He gets slipped some drugs by the drug dealer guy whose name is escaping me.
Keith.
So there's a drug dealer named Keith who tries to get him to take some drugs. He says no thanks. He drops one in his drink anyway.
Hey, we'll buy some drugs. Back triangles, man. They're fucking excellent, I'm telling you. Okay, if you change your mind, I'm Keith.
Of all the drug dealers I know, like, none of them give drugs away for free.
Right. It's not like he thought this guy was going to become a customer after that. Because the guy, he never does drugs again in the movie.
Right.
This is literally the only time that this character does drugs. Right. And he didn't even fucking pay for it.
Right.
So what was the point? Yeah, just kind of stuff like that. A lot of the stuff doesn't really ever lead anywhere. It just keeps setting up, like, look how dark this world mm-hmm. is.
Yeah.
Okay,
and
got it.
Scary and edgy. And
he ends up making friends with Jack Diddley. And I would argue that even though Evan is the first character we follow mm-hmm. in the movie, he's not the main character. In fact, I would argue there isn't a main character. I mean, Jack, who's played by Chris Pederson, he's kind of the leader. He's the leader of the group. who's called
T.R. House.
So, yeah, the character Jack, he is the leader of the T.R. House, which stands for The Rejected.
Mm-hmm.
And they all have to get a brand when they go to this house, which is, maybe that's another L.A. thing. I've lived in a lot of punk houses, never gotten a brand before, never been asked to get a brand before.
Well, listening to and reading about the L.A. scene back there, it was very close to, like, street gangs, you know? Like,
yes.
Suicidal tendencies, mm-hmm. they were basically a gang. And, you know, there were a couple others. I can't remember what all they were. But they operated kind of like street gangs, but it was more for protection from people that wanted to kick their ass. And so the branding doesn't seem that strange to me given that information.
Oddly enough, this movie does not really show the cops in that bad of a light.
No, it doesn't. Which is surprising.
They can, the stepdad's partner is almost seems a little bumbling, I guess.
Yeah, he's like Barney Fife or some shit.
Yeah, but he's not a bad guy. Right. And then the stepdad is a good guy.
Yeah, he wants to help him out. He protects them from the community who's pissed off about him. You know, he runs cover.
He saves them
multiple times. Right. Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
He stands up for them at that town hall meeting.
Yeah.
And he's protecting his stepson. It's not even his real son. That's his stepson. Mm-hmm. But he even says that your family.
Yeah.
You can come home anytime you want.
Yeah.
Which I'm not saying that a cop can't be a good person and care about people.
Right.
They can, but it just was surprising that even if they had him as the good cop, that they didn't have a bunch of other, you know, trigger happy asshole cops. This seems like the perfect setup to have a situation like that. And that would definitely, in my experience, be a little more accurate to the police that I've encountered in my life, anyway.
They very rarely portray him doing cop duties. He is doing parental duties. So,
yeah.
I mean, and I think that is a distinction that's important as far as being a cop goes, because, you know, all cops are bastards, but, you know, this guy seems to be a good dad. Despite being a fucking cop.
But Jack did seem to be one of the few who wasn't from seemingly a really fucked up home. Almost all the other... Well, I guess... And
Joe Schmo.
The kid... the kid with the gay dad.
Yeah, that's...
seemed like it.
Joe Schmo.
Joe Schmo, right.
Yeah. He has a really cool jacket, by the way. I really liked his jacket.
Some of the clothes in this movie, like, I really did like. Yeah. I mean, I definitely... I had that period too where I would wear like a lot of military surplus and just kind of like punk it up.
Yeah.
But yeah, the wardrobe in this movie, and it makes sense because these are actual punk rockers. So they were just wearing their clothes, right, presumably.
So back to the branding. Who was it that didn't want to get branded? Was that?
That was Joe Schmo.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Because you would think it would be Evan because he was kind of the doe eyed, innocent kid, but now he was like, yeah, no, I'll fucking do it. Yeah, give me the brand. Joe Schmo was the one who was like, nah, that's kind of weird for me. I'm gonna go home.
What's bad? Nobody's supposed to stay here unless they get a burn. See, it's kind of nice. Comes out like this.
Jesus, that could be there all your life.
Well, that's the idea. See, if we didn't do that, we'd have all kinds of flakes hanging around.
Yeah, well, this may be a stupid question, but what does it stand for anyways? It
stands for the Rejected.
Sounds really stupid to me. Yeah, well, stupid or not, I don't have anywhere else to go.
It's like some kind of ridiculous initiation or something.
So?
So I'm leaving.
Right, that's
and
right.
And then he went home and
he was
unhappy
about his...
And his dad's boyfriend were just passed out naked in the living room with the curtains open and the light on. And I'm like, who fucking does that?
If somebody is going to look in my windows at night, I may as well give them a show. You know what I mean?
Right.
I don't want to disappoint. Right. If you're taking the time and energy to look in my window, I will give you something to look at.
He just walked by, looked in the window, and was like, nope, and left. Don't know if you noticed this, But Joe Schmo in his bedroom had a Decline of Western Civilization poster.
He did.
So shameless self-plug.
Yeah, yeah. It was good.
Mm-hmm.
There were, speaking of just little Easter eggs, there was lots of crass graffiti, which I'm a big fan of. That was pretty cool.
Yep.
So did he wind up getting the brand?
Yep. He ended up just being like, eh, fuck it. And Sheila did pretty quickly too.
Uh-huh. And so what happened after that?
So they actually do go land pirating. Uh-huh. They go and look for open garages, run up in there and steal whatever like foodstuffs. You know, a lot of people in the suburbs have refrigerators in their garage that have like, and deep freezers mm-hmm. and stuff that have lots of like, you know, stock up on yep. just, you know, lots of food. Mm-hmm. So they're running in there and taking everything they can carry, which is pretty fucking awesome, yeah. actually.
Uh-huh. It's better than eating out of dumpsters. I wish I would have thought of that when I was eating out of dumpsters. So.
Also, I am a little disappointed that they, as far as I can remember anyway, they didn't show them stealing from, I guess Walmart wasn't really a thing yet.
Right.
I
mean, it was.
At least not in any real sense.
Yeah.
But they didn't show them stealing from big corporations. Right. I would have liked to have seen some of that. But that's harder to film because this film had a pretty small budget. It was $500,000 was the entire budget. So they probably just didn't have a location they could have used to be like, look like a big box store.
Right.
And I'm sure no big box store was willing to let them film there.
Yeah.
This was, you know, a good second option to show kind of how they're getting by. I'm kind of surprised that we never thought of doing anything like this. This was for me, they pretty much embody the kind of punk that I was, minus the sexual assault and mm-hmm. racism and homophobia. But that just the, I just don't give a shit. I just want to be kind of an angry nihilist.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really give a shit about politics. I mean, I was very, as we've discussed on our other podcast, very anti-political mm-hmm. when I was, you know, a baby punk.
Yeah.
I'm sick of people talking about politics. I don't want to mix politics in my punk rock,
mm-hmm.
which is a weird thought to have
mm-hmm.
looking back on it now.
And in the 90s that made it made sense, especially with
mm-hmm.
how punk rock had just blown up again, you know, because of Green mm-hmm. Day and everything. So a lot of people just getting into it and not knowing mm-hmm. the political aspects of it. The house that they live in is abandoned. That whole neighborhood is abandoned because they're yeah. going to put in a highway.
An interstate.
Which interstate is
yeah.
this?
I don't I-5? Remember. It might be I-5. But I do know in the trivia, the interstate took so long to construct because they actually were building an interstate on that spot. That part was real. And they did. And the interstate that they built took so long to build that it was also the same unfinished interstate from the movie Speed.
Yeah, that's right.
So the movie Speed was shot right above where Suburbia was shot. Yeah. So also Sandra Bullock makes a cameo in Suburbia. She does not. Yeah, TSOL is the next band who plays.
Yeah, it's just, there's not a lot happens at this point. You know, they go to the show. The Rednecks, they leave the show and mm-hmm. get in a fight with some jocks that drive by in a car and they'd like throw a can and hit Joe Schmo. And they get in a fight in somebody's yard. And then the cops are coming mm-hmm. and they run back to the show. And those frat boys or jocks or whatever come into the show and stab somebody and kill them. Not knowing who it was, just knew that it was a punker from the punk show.
Mm-hmm.
And for
and they revenge, stabbed they, the guy they stabbed was like an employee of the venue.
Yeah, he was what like the
yeah.
Bouncer or something. I don't know. Yeah, and so the cops all come and everybody has to run away, and they're asking about TR, so they all take their patches and stuff off.
So yeah, they have a scene with at the community meeting. I think that's after the stabbing because I think they mention it in the community meeting that, like, you know someone was stabbed at one of their shows. Yeah. Also, you know, the shows really obviously take place in LA and this is way out in the suburbs, so I don't know why these all kind of get shown as the same world. Also, that cop of that small town in random place in Southern California would have zero jurisdiction in Los Angeles.
Right.
None. Like, police are employed by the city or municipality they're in, and they can't just go be a cop all over the country. It seems like he's like a municipal cop, though. Yeah, it seems like he's a cop for whatever fake-ass town they've decided that is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they probably just didn't put that much thought into it. They're like, whatever, he's a cop, and he's going to be wherever the fuck we need him to be, because it's a $500,000 movie.
So what's next? Is that when...
Oh...
The little brother comes to stay.
Yeah.
Evan's little brother comes to stay with him from the little brother from the beginning of the movie.
Right, yeah.
So their mom gets arrested and he is at the neighbor's house and Evan just goes and picks him up.
Yeah.
And he just walks out of the neighbor's house and the neighbors are like, all right, bye. Not even questioning it. Like, okay, well, see you later. Yeah.
And yeah, his name is Ethan. They give Ethan a mohawk, and he's adorable.
He looks pretty badass, actually.
Yeah. And so is that the next show? Is that they go to the TSOL show next? Is that right?
I think he comes to live with them after the TSOL show. Then the final show is the Vandals.
Right. So before.
Yeah.
So, okay, the TSOL show, and then Ethan comes and lives with them. They go to the Vandals show, which I gotta say I miss the original Vandals singer. I think they would be a much different band if they had still had him. So the show they play Pat Brown, which is fun. I love that song. And then so they go home, and is that when the Rednecks find out where they live?
The stepdad comes to the squat after the city meeting.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, you guys need to clear out of here. Just promise me you'll clear out of here. I don't care where you go. I don't care what you do. I just need you to be safe.
Yeah.
So please clear out. I can't stop these guys forever. They're eventually going to come when I'm not looking, and they're coming for blood.
I can't protect you. Yeah.
Basically. Yeah.
Yeah. And then
that had the only two laugh out loud moments in the entire movie for me.
The beginning, so good.
The opening scene where the dog destroys a doll.
Uh-huh.
But when he asks them, he says, well, yeah, what can I do to get you guys? And they've all walked off. They're like, we're not going to pay attention to you. You're a cop. They all walk into different rooms and slam the doors. And he's standing in the middle of the hallway going, do I have to pay you to leave? And right then all the doors open and there's even a kid who like
pops comes his down head from, out the, from ceiling. The ceiling. It's so funny.
Look, you're going to have to listen up sooner or later. I'm not leaving until you do. What do I have to do, for Christ's sakes? Pay you?
He asked them, what do you guys do for money? And he goes, get paid off by cops.
Yeah.
that was also my second actual, like, that's a funny line. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, they agree to move out because, you know, it's getting kind of intense. Somebody got killed and shit. So, then two of the rednecks come and break into the house and find Sheila and rip her shirt off and toss her around and make veiled threats to everybody about getting out of there, which causes Sheila, who has trauma from her dad abusing her, to intentionally overdose on Keith's stash.
Yes. Yes.
And, you know,
and she does not survive.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, it cuts to, you know, there's that horrible scene and it cuts to the next morning and Keith is looking for a stash and can't find it. And everybody's just like giving him shit about how he probably just did it all. And he's a burnout. And blah, 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 mm-hmm. blah, blah. And then they find Sheila, who is dating Joe Schmo. Mm-hmm. They're together and in love. And they find her body, and everybody is super fucking pissed and really, really mean to Keith.
What's going on?
You and your stupid dope. This is what I think, you're dope.
What are you doing? Man, what did you do that for? That's crazy.
Sheila's dead. That's what happened to your stupid dope.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I wonder if this is, it doesn't talk about drug abuse much or anything like that, but I wonder if like there's some straight edge sensibilities coming out in this as well. I don't think it was much of a big deal.
Well, and like I noticed too that like when she died, so earlier in the movie, she had been reading a fairy tale book to Ethan. Yeah. The kid
and those two girls
and two of the other punk girls said Ethan fell asleep, and they said, can you keep reading? Mm-hmm. And she said, why, he's already asleep. And they just said, well, we just want to hear the book.
Mm-hmm. Oh, come on, don't stop,
but he's asleep.
But we're not, read it to us, come on.
Aren't you a little old for fairy tales?
Please.
And, you know, I feel like that she felt she, you know, unalived herself while reading the fairy tale book on purpose, because she also had that kind of, you know, wanted to go back to, she wanted to feel like that innocence mm-hmm. of, you know, this fairy tale book.
Right.
So,
yeah,
that was, I did think that was a really like good attention to detail
mm-hmm.
on the director's part of Definitely. Like having her be reading the fairy tale book as she dies.
Well, and it, you know, and those two girls that are listening to the book, mm-hmm. it shows and reminds us that they're just kids. Like these are runaways. These are still
right. These
children.
Are like 15, 14, 15, 16 year olds. These aren't,
they're still
20 somethings.
Right. They're still innocent.
Yeah.
Like they still want somebody to read them books. And for whatever reason, they didn't have that at mm-hmm. home. And so they found a chosen family and were receiving some of that love and community in another place. That was both those scenes when she was reading to them, and then obviously when she overdosed with the book. I think those are really important scenes. So then they decide not to leave because the rednecks fucking did that, and they basically decide to go to war.
In the next scene, they go to,
well, they take her body to her parents because they don't know what else to do with her, so they wrap her up and they're like, she died, we didn't know what to do with her, so we brought her home to you, you know. And her parents didn't really react.
And I'm wondering if part of that is because, like, she didn't use a lot of real actors.
Yeah, maybe.
Or because they were, I don't know if that was intentional or if that was just kind of stale acting. Uh-huh. It's hard to tell.
They took her body and then they went to the funeral. And, you know, they didn't have nice clothes because they're fucking squatters. So they show up in their clothes that they own. And, you know, her family members were uncomfortable. And so it turns into a brawl because they ask them to leave. And, the kids are like, well, she's our friend, too. You know, we're here to mourn her, too. And it just sucks. It's horrible. And then, like, during the fight, somebody brings up that their niece was assaulted at that show. So, you know, it's the callback to the beginning of the movie, which I guess is the only reason for that scene to exist, which I think is fucking bullshit.
I think so. And I don't think that that added anything to that other scene either.
I hate it.
Well, and it's made clear because it's made complete. I guess Sheila had talked about it that, you know, her father had sexually assaulted her, starting at a young age.
She had scars on her back too, right?
From she had scars on her back. So, he would, I guess, become aroused and would blame her for it and then would beat her.
Yeah.
It was pretty detailed. It was
pretty
detailed. They really set the scene out. And I don't know if that is maybe if the director had known somebody who'd had that specific experience. It seemed very specific.
Yeah.
I think he was crazy. You get this look in his eye. And I would know. Uh-oh, trouble. I'd wake up in the night, and he'd be touching me all over. He'd get all turned on, you know? And then instead of actually raping me, he could stop himself by beating me up. Does that make any sense?
But they make it, you know, very clear that they know what her dad did at the funeral. Because,
They call him out on it.
If it weren't for you, she'd probably still be alive.
No, asshole. If it wasn't for you, she'd still be alive.
Don't you say that. You don't know anything about us.
Yes, I do. Sheila told me all about you. She told me how you couldn't keep your hands off
her. Shut up!
You molested your own daughter, you scumbag. And then you beat her. She showed me the scars. You're a fucking asshole. You know that?
And then get kicked out of the funeral home in the next, you know, at the next scene.
And then they're back at their squat and, you know, it cuts to the rednecks at the strip club. And wow, strip clubs in the 80s sure were different.
You know, because they hate these kids so much. But one of the things that they don't really seem to understand is they look at these kids. They don't see them as kids. They see them as a threat. Mm-hmm. They see them as near peers who are a threat to them when these are kids that, you know, them as being the same generation as those kids' parents is the generation who fucking utterly failed these kids.
Yeah, exactly.
So completely.
Yeah.
They on the one hand are also losing their jobs in their world, but they have created a world that is a living hell for these kids. Yep. They can't see beyond their own anger. So yeah, rednecks at the strip club. One of them says, you know, he found out where they are. Like, you know, hey, we got to go now, get them.
Yeah, they knew where they were because they found them that one time. But they're like, we got to go back because they fucked up this funeral.
Can you imagine how that girl's mother felt? Her only daughter up there in a box. And those son of a bitches come in, wreck the place, and then brutalize the family? Unbelievable. I mean, I'm not religious.
But if you ask me, that's downright sinful.
We're going to have to go back out there.
That's what I was thinking.
So they go back there.
It was it was called the Kit Kat Club. That's the name of the club.
Nice.
Yeah.
I
don't know if it's real. Somebody look that up.
So they bust into their squat, and the kids kick their asses. Razzle sixes dogs on them, and they run away. Or they drive away, and we think they're done. So, you know, the kids are all out celebrating that they defeated the shitty rednecks when they turn their car around and try to run them down or intimidate them or something and wind up hitting Ethan, the little brother. It was like,
yeah,
what,
the
6 or 7 year
the
old?
The youngest.
6 or 7 years.
He's probably
old
like, I think he's supposed to be like 8. Okay. 8 or 9, probably.
And kill him.
He's still riding around on a big wheel. Yeah. He's riding around on a big wheel. So he's like a kid.
Yeah, a little tiny kid, yeah. And they kill him. And that's basically the end of the movie.
Yeah. And right after they hit him with the car, that's when the stepdad cop finally gets there. He was on his way there to try to stop these guys from doing this. And the cop car pulls up behind the rednecks with the dead child still on their windshield.
Bloody.
The ending was way more shocking than the beginning.
Yeah,
I completely forgot the end of the movie.
Oh, I didn't.
I was worried about the beginning, especially, like we're both dads.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, because that's for whatever reason, that's the one that lived on in my mind, was that beginning with the vicious dogs eating that toddler. But the ending of the movie, because it's the beginning scene is so fake that you almost can't help but laugh. Right. Yeah, in a real situation, that would be a tragedy, but it just looks so phony. But the ending, you actually see like a bloody kid on the windshield. Yeah. Obviously, makeup and shit. Mm-hmm. But I mean, like they should. It's about the most real looking thing in the movie.
Yeah, it's pretty rough.
To me, I.
complicated feelings.
So we've given a pretty good overview of the movie. I also take issue with the fact that the bad guys drove an El Camino.
Yeah.
I drove an El Camino when I was a punk rocker, and I will not stand for this anti-El Camino sentiment
that people have. Yeah, I mentioned while watching it, my wife walked in, and I mentioned how I wanted an El Camino, and she would never let me buy an El Camino. Why can't I have an El Camino?
In my El Camino, I had a Mohawk when I drove it, so I had to tilt my head to the side because El Caminos have low roofs drive like that. Yeah. So it was worth it, though, man. For sure. Like, you got to make sacrifices when you got an El Camino.
Did your El Camino have a name?
I think I just called it Rusty because it was rusted out of shit.
It's a good name for an El Camino.
So we like to do, in every episode, we like to do positives and negatives of every movie, whether we like it or not. We like to find the good things, and you know, if we don't like it, find what's good about it. Even if we do like it, figure out what's bad about it. Nothing's perfect. So what are the negatives? What are three negatives you'd give this movie?
I mean, obviously the sexual assault, racism, and homophobia are gross. I would prefer that not be in there. I want to say something about the acting, but I almost think it's charming, so I'm not going to
agree. I think it bothered me at first, but after I kind of got used to it, I thought, you know, it's not that bad. It works for this movie.
I would, I don't know. I mean, the only thing that really bugs me about it is the racism and homophobia and misogyny. You know, the sexual assaults are really unnecessary, and it's just cruel as a plot device, and I don't think it's necessary. You know, I would like to see more shows, more bands playing.
Yeah, I agree. I did like, you know, I guess I'll get into this in my positive, but I did like that they had the bands in there, and I thought that was good that they actually filmed at actual punk shows. And presumably all the extras were people who were just at the show. So that was pretty cool. But I guess I'll give my negatives, and then you can give your positives. So I agree. I originally, like, cause I started putting down negatives and positives right when I started the movie, and I originally put the bad acting, but yeah, I agree. That's actually not, it doesn't bother me that much. And I kind of like that it was, you know, not a bad thing that they used real punk rockers and that there was some kind of authenticity to the movie then. It does make it kind of a little more DIY. But yeah, the negatives for me, one, the unnecessary racism, homophobia, and sexual assault and misogyny. And it just kind of felt out of place in a movie about a bunch of fucking punk rockers. Right. I almost expected one of them to like suddenly have a microphone in his hand with a brick wall behind him. And, like,
take my wife, ill-fitting please. Suit.
I was just like, what is this doing? That was the same scene where they way overdid the guess what chicken butt.
Yeah, that was bad.
Hey, guess what? Three. What? Guess chicken butt.
Which is, another, I'll add that to this too. Of just like,
good call.
Guess what chicken butt? And they're all laughing their asses off. And I'm just thinking, what drugs are they on that has made this joke this fucking funny? Because it just looks like they're drinking. But that also is part of that, like, they're like 14, 15 years old.
I was known to say, guess what, chicken butt, like every now and again, but not repeatedly for 5 minutes.
Right. Know? And they laugh every time they say it. They laugh as if it's the first time they've ever heard it.
Now,
even though they just heard it a minute before.
Guess how, on the other hand, I love to say, because then I get to say chicken cow and then sing the Wesley Willis song, Chicken Cow.
Yeah.
So we'll bite you in the face and stab you in the ass.
Which is way better than the joke. Wesley, anything by Wesley Willis is way better than that.
Yeah.
It can rip your head off. It can fly as high as a bird. It can bite your face. The chicken cow. The chicken cow.
Another negative for me was, the kind of plot devices that never went anywhere. Mm-hmm. Or were unnecessary. Like, even if they did go somewhere, it still didn't really add anything. Like the opening scene, sexual assault, the whole, you know, my stepdad's a black cop. The cop thing came into play, but the black thing, he could have just been black and it like didn't need to be mentioned.
Right.
Like, we know it's a stepdad. Right. We're not being like, hey, how the hell is a stepdad black and he's white? Like, that's not something that people... I don't know. It was the 80s. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was less common.
Yeah,
but,
I don't know.
I mean...
It's unnecessary.
Yeah. And the homophobia and... Yeah, just... Yeah, the plot devices that never went anywhere. They would set something up to be a major plot device later. And then it just would end up being just like a one-off line. And you're like, okay, well, I guess they technically tied it back in.
Right.
That, you know, kind of like half-assed Chekhov's gun.
Right.
Yeah, kind like of very thing. Where it's like, we're just going to show you this thing and then mention it. It would be like, yeah, if they showed Chekhov's gun above the fireplace and then later on just re-mention the same gun. Right. You know, like, okay, you're tying it back in, sure, but the gun didn't go off.
Hey,
so
I have a gun over the fireplace. Point? Did you know that?
Right. It just didn't... So cool. For me, that was that and the cheesy special effects. And
yeah.
I get they were on a budget, mm-hmm. but their $500,000 budget is $1.6 million today. Mm-hmm. So technically,
that's still
their budget was higher than the 1996 Suburbia budget, which was $657,000, which would be $1.3 million today. So they had a higher budget than the 1996 Suburbia.
To be fair, it's more bang for your buck because it's a much better movie.
It is a way better movie. I'm not even saying it's that good. Mm-hmm. It's just that much better. Mm-hmm. What are some positives you'd give this movie?
I mean, that obviously that they used real punk rockers and that they had real punk bands play shows and they record the shows. I also think that it's a pretty good representation of what it was like to be an outcast punk rocker in a suburban area. I mean, granted, we didn't get, none of our friends got killed by rednecks or anything like that, but you know, we were targeted for sure for being different and weird, and we had very strong community ties with one another and were basically a family for, you know, all those years running around fucking shit up. It was very realistic. Aside from some of the more outlandish shit, like the toddler getting eaten by a dog and stuff. I mean, that's kind of goofy, but, you know, the everyday lives of those kids was very similar and relatable to what we did in, you know, 95, 96, 97, 2000, you know, it was very, very similar,
yeah.
Very realistic. I think it was a good portrayal of punk kids.
I definitely like, and I know you have too. I felt, unsafe definitely by rednecks just driving by and shouting things and sometimes even pulling over. And I don't know. Yeah. You know, we've talked about this on the podcast before, but like, you know, I've had people get out of the truck and like straight up punch me because I flipped them off.
I've had stuff
when they screamed F slurs at me and all I did was flip them off and they stopped and kicked my ass for it. And it was just like, you know, outnumbered who just wanted to pick on some guy walking down the street minding his own business. And, you know, eventually we're going to cover the movie Bomb City, which emotionally, I don't think I'm looking forward to, if I'm being completely honest. Yeah. It's a good movie. But yeah, that stuff didn't just happen in California. You know, Bomb City takes place in Texas. It happened in Kansas. It happened, I'm guessing, you know, probably in Minnesota, Illinois, New York. I mean, it happened everywhere.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and Matthew Shepard wasn't a punk rocker, but he was still victimized by shitty fucking rednecks, you know, just because, I mean, anybody that was different or weird was victimized by people in the 90s, 80s, 90s. I mean, forever really, but you know what we're talking about is mostly the 90s. I mean, Matthew Shepard was what, 96,
something like that,
something like that. I don't know. Yeah. And you know, Bomb City is about a biopic about a punk rocker that got killed in Amarillo, Texas by a fucking jock who got off basically scot-free.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just very realistic. You know, I like the music and the scene stuff and and the history of it. I mean, it's a punk rock classic.
Yeah.
It didn't hold up quite as strongly as I thought it would, but it's still overall, it's still like a good movie, and it's a punk rock classic for a reason. You know.
And I think a lot of the positives I'd give it was, the portrayals of the squat. I mean, it reminds me of a lot of punk houses I lived in. I mean, Central House, too.
Yeah.
I mean, that's basically how filthy that fucking place was. I was looking at the squat they lived in. I thought, that is not that far off from Central House, too. Yeah. So the attention to detail.
I'm sure they used a real fucking squat, to be honest.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, if I found out that was a real squat, it wouldn't surprise me. It looked like a squat, but all the attention to detail, and there were little things. I did appreciate the little Easter eggs. I thought, you know, the scene where she, you know, overdoses and, you know, is reading fairy tale books was, I mean, that was, you know, a tragic scene, but it was well done. And that attention to detail, I think, was one of the good things about this movie. Of course, the bands and them shooting at the actual shows was fucking great. I'm really glad that they had DI, TSOL, and the Vandals on there. And I forgot how much I actually liked all those bands, especially the earliest iterations of those bands. Like, I had forgotten what, like, old Vandals actually sounded like. It has been so long since I listened to When in Rome, and I just thought, like, wow, god damn, that's such a good fucking era for the Vandals. And then, of course, one of my other positives, something this movie has over the other Suburbia, is the fucking runtime. The runtime is perfect.
What is it?
They had it at a tight hour and a half. I think it was maybe a little over an hour and a half, but not much. It was pretty, it hit the beats where it was supposed to and kept moving. It didn't feel like it dragged on like the other Suburbia did.
Right.
And yeah, there wasn't any point, unlike the other Suburbia, where I thought, like, fuck, is this movie still going? like, you know, I'd pause and go do something, and I'd be like, oh man, this movie's moving right along. I only got, like, you know, 30 minutes left in this thing. Which is always a good thing when the movie's moving faster than you thought it was. So what would you do to make this movie better?
Removing the superfluous sexual assaults, and the homophobia and racism. It's just not important. It doesn't add anything to it. It just makes me feel bad. I mean, the acting, I mean, like I said, I think it's endearing and a little bit charming that, it's so bad. I don't know.
Right. I mean, there's almost an innocence to the acting, which adds to the innocence of the characters too. Cause it reminds you that these really are just fucking kids.
Yeah.
The actors are just kids playing kids. I don't know if it would work in every movie, but it works in this movie.
Agreed. Yeah.
for how I'd make a better Sam, I take out all the, you know, racism, homophobia, sexual assault, unless it's going somewhere or going to prove some kind of point. Further, are we going to see characters grow because of it or something like that? But it's unnecessary and it doesn't go anywhere.
Right.
And I think I would add more music. I want to see more shows. And I realize it's, you know, it's not a documentary. Right. I get that, but
where's the Germs? Where's the Circle Jerks? Where's Black Flag?
Right. Right. I would have loved to have seen more bands, from the time. And, you know, it sounds like we're like, you know, maybe talking shit, but Penelope Spheris really had mostly done like documentary type stuff before then. So this is kind of her starting to do more scripted material. Mm-hmm. She does go on to write a lot more movies. Mm-hmm. So before this, she'd done a couple other feature films that I personally have not seen, and they don't have pages anywhere. So I think they might be like short films. I think this is her first feature length non-documentary, if I'm remembering right. Mm-hmm. So she did Suburbia, and then she did a movie called The Boys Next Door, Hollywood Vice Squad in 1986. She did a movie called Dudes and Summer Camp Nightmare in 1987. Nice. So for Summer Camp Nightmare, she was only the writer for that. She was the director of the movie Dudes. And then after that, she got her biggest movie to date, which was a movie called Wayne's World. Anyone familiar with the Saturday Night Live sketch starring Mike Myers and Dana Carvey probably knows what Wayne's World is, or maybe you just know it from the movie. But that was a box office hit and is still to this day, at least at time of recording, the biggest, most successful Saturday Night Live movie.
Mm-hmm.
It is still, I enjoy that movie. I like Wayne's World a lot. Mm-hmm. And she did not get along with Mike Myers on the set. Mike Myers apparently wanted Wayne's World to be just about Wayne, and Garth was going to be a cameo in just the TV show within a TV show scenes.
That's so dumb.
And Penelope Spheris is the one who pushed for it to be a buddy comedy.
Yeah.
Which, in my mind, is the only fucking way that movie works.
Right. Well because
so
Mike Myers is just fucking insufferable.
And Dana Carvey seems like a sweetheart. Yeah. I don't know him, but he seems like a sweetheart.
He does.
Yeah.
She also did Black Sheep and The Little Rascals.
She did.
Which I did not know.
And the Beverly Hillbillies movie.
Wow. Have you seen all three Decline movies?
No, I have only seen the first one.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So I got some catching up.
The
to do.
Third one is upsetting.
Should we do? Well, I know the second one was metal, so not technically a punk movie. Yeah. But should we do Decline 1 and 3 or just the first one, do you think?
Oh, we should do both.
Okay. Yeah. Let's do it. So yeah, for her documentary, like you said, she did the Decline of Western Civilizations 1, 2 and 3. In 1981, 1988, and then the third one was in 1998. She did a documentary called Thunder and Mud, Band in the USA, Holly Weird, and We Sold Our Souls for Rock and Roll. So she's kind of, she has a lot of different credits and even has some acting credits.
Yeah.
She directed some music videos in the 80s, including two for Megadeth.
Nice.
You know, the conservative Christian band Megadeth. Never would have guessed when I was in middle school that Megadeth was going to go in that direction.
Yeah.
Seems strange for a band called Megadeth to kind of go in that direction. Yeah. But hey, this movie to me, I enjoyed it, and it's on the verge of being a really good movie. Mm. It's so close. Mm. And I think, with a few changes, it really could have been phenomenal.
Yeah, agreed.
But I guess now it's time for our rating system. And like I always say, we have two rating systems. We judge movies based on how punk they are. Is it a poser movie, a punk'em or rocker movie, or an upper crust movie? Upper crust being the highest and poser being the lowest. And then we also have a good to bad scale, which what should we use as a metric this time? We change it every time.
How about Wild Dogs? Seven
Wild Dogs. I love it.
I'm going to call, I'm going to rate this a punk-a-rock movie, and not upper crust. It's almost upper crust, but it's not very punk rock to be racist and homophobic.
You bastard, I should have gone first, because I'm also giving it a punk-a-rocker for the exact same fucking reasons. It would have been upper crust, because, man, they live at a squat. Yeah. It is fucking accurate. They used real punk rockers, but it is not punk to be fucking racist, sexist, homophobic, and participate in sexual assault.
Right.
Not fucking punk.
Yeah.
So it gets punk-a-rocker for the squat and the music. Mm-hmm. All right. Out of seven stray dogs, you know what? I'm going to be generous. I'm right on the line. But I'm going to go ahead and give it a five. I'm going to give it a five stray dogs out of seven. I was almost gave it a four because of all the previously mentioned sexism, racism, and homophobia. But I think if you subtracted that from the movie, it would be a solid fucking movie. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed the shit out of everything but those parts.
Yeah. I was going to give it five stray dogs as well.
Nice.
Five out of seven.
So we're in agreement on both ratings on this one.
Yeah. It's a good movie. I love it still. Yeah. You know, it's it's problematic. It's troublesome. Yeah. Some parts of it are really gross. But it's also a punk rock classic, and I just can't not enjoy it.
Oh, I have one correction, or addition, I should say, to last episode, the 1996 Suburbia. So, as we were discussing, Tim has, you know, is coded as having PTSD. Mm-hmm. And we were trying to figure out when Camp Le Menier became a base used by the United States Navy, which is the only permanent, underline the word permanent, military installation, U.S. military installation in a third world country. So it became a permanent military installation in 2002.
Huh? Yeah.
Well after he would have been back.
Yep. True that.
So he can't even use the excuse that he was there.
Nope. Fuck that guy.
So it, like a lot of other military installations, is a post 9/11 reaction.
Yeah. All right. What movie are we going to do next? Oh, The Day the Country Died. A History of Anarcho-Punk in the UK or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Sweet. Yeah. That's going to be fun. Because the anarcho scene in the UK in the 80s is one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Of all
time.
And
I'm excited to do something from the UK.
Yeah.
Everything we've done so far has been pretty American based.
Yeah.
But the UK, I think, is pretty well known for having a pretty vibrant punk scene. And if you don't know that, then there's a list of bands we need to get to.
Right.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to doing that one. There unfortunately is, at least as far as I can tell, no trailer for it.
No.
So I can't play the trailer at the end, but I will play a few clips.
Yeah.
At the end of this episode as a little teaser for the next one. This one is, I have a feeling, I have not watched it. I have a feeling it is super DIY. Like probably even more so than the Outhouse one.
I have watched it at least once. It's also, it's by the same guy who wrote the book of the same name, and I am reading the book as well. It's slow going. I'm only reading a couple chapters at a time. You know, each chapter is a band from the scene. So yeah,
that's good. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And if anyone would like to also watch this movie, it's called The Day the Country Died: History of Anarcho-Punk. It's on YouTube. So I think that is the only place you can find it.
You can buy the DVD somewhere. I don't think there's American distribution for it. I think it might just be Ian Glasper doing it out of his house, to be honest.
Yeah, that's DIY.
Yeah, so we're looking forward to that. If anybody wants us to review anything, message us or email us.
We've got a few that we know we're probably going to do. River's Edge, Straight to Hell. In October, we're going to do Green Room. And
Return of the Living Dead.
Return of the Living Dead, right. And we're at some point going to do SLC Punk.
Yeah.
I don't want to jump to conclusion. I'm pretty sure I know what rating I'm going to give it already, but it has been a long
time since I've seen it.
So yeah. So I'm going to give it a chance.
I think the last time I watched it, I still lived at the Boston apartments. Yeah. It's been a minute. I wonder, I mean, I remember not hating it. Thanks for our one Patreon subscriber, Mr. Power. We appreciate you. Your generous contribution to our podcasting efforts. Find us on all our socials if you want.
Yeah. And visit our website at www.prairiepunkpress.com. You can find all the links there, all of our socials, and links to our Patreon page, to our Ko-fi page, our YouTube page, pretty much everything you can find from the website. And yeah, don't forget to like, subscribe, leave a comment, you know, spread the word and, donate that way. If you can't afford to donate financially, thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll see you next time.
Bye.
In Belfast, we never really saw, anarcho-punk. We never defined it as that. It was kind of anarchism, and punk was just a kind of cultural process attached to it.
It kind of solidified much more around playing songs, and I started to write songs quite seriously at that point. And the songs I was writing, you know, were kind of, you know, affected by our environment and by all the other things that was, you know, by that time the whole sort of like punk thing had taken off, and I mean, I never regarded myself as a punk, really.
Enjoy life and let others enjoy life too. Don't force people to do things they don't want to do. That's it, you know? No gods, no masters.
What?
Not freeway traffic. Not freaking butt.